Notes from the LEFT Forum 2017, Part 3. The conference titled Resistance was held in New York City June 2nd through June 4th, and it looked at questions of power, strategy, and tactics as the resistance to Donald Trump rises. The focus of many panels this year was on moving beyond Trump into an examination of the system which produced him. Part 3 of Notes from the LEFT Forum is drawn from a panel on resisting NYPD gang policing, as well as a discussion on black and black crime, myth or reality. We'll hear from criminologist and sociologist David Brotherton, Nick Powers with The Independent, and Kazembe Balogun with the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation. We begin with Dr. David Brotherton, who teaches at the CUNY Graduate Center, the City University of New York's Graduate Center, and at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, as NYPD gang raids in early morning hours have alarmed parents and public housing residents. While new figures show crime in New York City is down, Brotherton says it doesn't matter if crime is up or down as far as resources and policing is concerned. Dr. Brotherton.
There'll always be a demand from the police themselves for more policing. Doesn't matter if the crime goes down. If it goes down, we need more police to make sure it doesn't go up. And if it goes up, we need more police to make sure it doesn't, right? So it doesn't matter. But all the time, as they want more and more resources, and by the way, try to figure out what the budget is of the NYPD, I mean, you have to be Sherlock Holmes. I mean, there are so many different budget, right, coming from different sources, from state, government, from drug raids. God knows where a lot of this money goes, by the way. It's like a parallel state, essentially. So you have to understand the continuity of this. And now in a period of, as Alex writes, ultra-militarization of the police, right, where the police doesn't simply get trained anymore by the police. The police constantly interact with every other military force of the state to get its training. And I'll give you one little example of this, which surprised me. The other day, I was in immigration court. I do a lot of court hearings as an expert. I've written books on deportation to stop people getting deported. And I'm in the waiting room, and I'm talking about to the brother of a guy who's being deported, a very sick man. And I'm talking to his brother, and I said, well, how did you, what happened when your brother got picked up? He said, yeah, Dave, it was really amazing. It was like some tactical team came breaking through our house in Washington Heights at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. This was an afternoon raid. And they broke in, he said, they were like from four units. I said, well, what's all units? He says, well, there was the ICE, and there was the NYPD, and there was the FBI, and there was, he said, I forget what the other one was. I said, well, your brother has no history of drug dealing. He's 42 years of age, he's on disability, he's eaten up with arthritis and psoriasis. He hasn't worked for 3 years. He has no priors, he's never been in prison in his life. He said, yeah, I know. He said, they came in, and I said, well, what happened to your brother? Because I read this in the file. He said, well, this big guy comes in the front with like a big ninja jacket, he said. And he goes up to my brother's having a cup of coffee in the kitchen, and he smashes him over the head with the butt of his pistol. And I said, well, how many times did he hit him? He said, he hit him 3 times. And he fell to the floor, and we all thought he was dead. I said, your brother? He said, there was blood coming out of his, and he was completely unconscious. And one of the other guys, and there was, I said, how many people? He said, oh, there must have been 25 people in the house. And his mum's a 62-year-old woman. She's on disability as well. She's got type 1 diabetes or whatever it is. So the guy's completely out. This other guy says to him, I think he's dead. You better get the out of here. He said, I don't give a fucking shit. Let him die. And I'm going, what is this? What world are we living in? So as I'm sitting there, I'm listening to this guy. And this guy, the guy who's getting deported, has filed charges against the police. And his brother, that's why they've locked him up again. They've come to pick him up because he's got charges against him. So I looked up on the, and I studied these ICE and this, and I'm looking up on my phone, and I'm looking up for, you know, who's this special team from ICE? It's called Special Response Team, SRT. Look it up. Look it up. They train at Fort Benning, Georgia. And guess who they train with? Navy SEALs. They're trained by Navy SEALs. These guys, they said, and the thing it said, we only accept 5% of applications. and you get extra money for being in this space. These are the kinds of, this is the culture that produces basically these armed thugs of the state. Could easily be Turkey, right? It could easily be Russia. It could easily, what? It happens to be here, right? In this cosmopolitan city of culture, right? City of tolerance, of zero tolerance, right? And so this is the culture that we, that now this is the norm. This is why these gang raids happen on such a scale. This is why there's money for these gang raids, right? And nobody thinks about the collateral damages and the consequences. It's such a shame that the other two people are not here who've seen their children get put away for 55 years, by the way. 18, 19-year-old children got in prison for 55 years for conspiracy laws. The second thing I want to say, and I'll finish, because I'm going to take time for the two brothers, is that the what goes on here, what creates this culture, which is a major weapon in this culture, right, is the use of what we call the moral panic. Okay? There's a book recently come out, if you checked it out, by Brooke Gladstone. She has this, you know, all a media show and WNYC. And she's sort of focusing on the moral panic. The moral panic concept, the moral panic, comes out of criminology back in the 60s. Comes out of England, where I'm from, where we, you know, we wrote about mods and rockers, right? Or later skinheads or drug takers, you know, the whole drugs war, and how you build up. You have to build up this whole pantomime, really, around the social problem in order not to address the social problem. You need this orchestration of people's fears, people's anxieties, in order to stampede them in a certain direction, that the othering of these people, the dehumanization of these people, right? The character assassination of these people is not only acceptable, it's necessary. The dangerous classes. And so what we live in now is a permanent moral panic. Trump is the end result, is the quintessential exemplar of the perpetrator of the moral panic. He is there due to moral panicking, you see. And he can't let it go. That's why he tweets all the time. You see, he's addicted to the moral panic. Right? He has moral panicitis. And so we live in this period of the moral panic. And so for us, you know, comrades and people in the resistance, we need an analysis that basically exposes how these moral panics work and how the media plays into the moral panic, sometimes willingly and sometimes completely unconsciously, because it's news. Who gives a shit? I've got to make the money, right? I've got to cover the story. But you are leading this. You are creating the cultural groundwork for this to take place. And the final point I want to make is this. They're not just doing gang raids. This is what the interesting thing is, right? Cyrus Vance has a whole bunch of prosecutors who work under him, right, to oversee the charges, right? They're like, you know, they're like the FRACOR of the court, Right? Conspiracy laws, send your kids away, who gives a shit? They deserve it. At the same time, Cyrus Vance has billions of dollars in his account from the banks who paid fines in order for none of the bastards to go to prison. Billions. 2.5 billion, whatever it is, I forget what the number is. Right? He didn't know what to do with all that money. So he gave it to some of us at CUNY, at the Center for the Study of Government, to dish out. To whom? To certain areas, a hotspot, they're called hotspot areas in New York, where these gang raids are happening, to fund non-profits, right, in prevention of violence. $65 million he just gave out in February to about 22 non-profits. So at the same time, listen, check this out, at the same time, this is how it works, right? Capitalism, right? The big guys, the real gangsters, the banksters, don't go to prison, but they get out of jail card by paying it off, blood money, our blood. That money comes to the state or the city. The city doesn't know what to do with it, so we throw it around the violence. They're probably putting some money in the NYPD because they always need more money. And it all goes on at the same time. So we get the right hand of the state, the highly coercive hand of the state, right, this militarized hand of the state, And at the same time as we have this pastoral hand of the state, the so-called nurturing, the preventive, the more rational, all happening simultaneously. Right? And that's what happens. That's what capitalism needs. What the thing is obviously what's going, you know, more and more is the right hand of the state, more and more coerciveness. But it can't be just coercive, because otherwise we can't call ourselves a democracy. So we stick in a little bit of the pastoral hand. But it all works simultaneously. And that's in this, in that context that these gang raids are taking place. Thanks very much.
Sociologist and criminologist Dr. David Brotherton. And you're listening to Notes from the Left Forum, Part 3, drawn from a panel on resisting NYPD gang policing, as well as a discussion on black-on-black crime, myth or reality. Here's former New York City Mayor and Trump advisor Rudy Giuliani back in July on Face the Nation.
There's too much violence in the black community. So a black will die 1% or less at the hands of the police and 99% at the hands of a civilian, most often another black. So if you want to protect black lives, then you got to protect black lives not just against police, which happens rarely, although with tremendous attention, and which happens every 14 hours in Chicago. Every 14 hours, and we never hear from Black Lives Matter. Well, so, if you want to deal with this on the black side, you've got to teach your children to be respectful to the police, and you've got to teach your children that the real danger to them is not the police. The real danger to them, 99 out of 100 times, 9,900 out of 1,000 times, are other black kids who are going to kill them. That's the way they're going to die.
So, Mr. Mayor.
Giuliani's comments on black-on-black crime was seen as a racist conservative attack to reinforce mass incarceration by many, including our next speaker, poet, journalist, and professor Nick Powers with The Independent.
The image of Giuliani on TV was seared into my brain when he said, we are, in a sense, kind of rescuing black people from black people. He said, black people kill more black people than white cops ever could. I'm paraphrasing, but essentially that's what he said. And when he said that, he was not only justifying mass incarceration for a mass audience, not only in a sense bolstering Donald Trump's election campaign, but he also was overlapping a prior conversation that was actually happening within the black community itself. I remember when I first heard the phrase black on black crime. It was in the 90s. And it did not come from outside the community. It came from inside the community. There was a very real panic about what was happening in our families, in our streets, in our neighborhoods. And because it was coming from within the community, it didn't have the sense of selling out, betraying each other. It was a very serious accounting. How can we repair the damage that has been done by racism, by poverty, by mass incarceration onto our families and our neighborhoods? But when this language has been kept inside the community, because there was always this fear that if black anxiety over crime seeped outside of the family, outside of the circle, it would be vacuumed up by racial conservatives and be used as an excuse to reinforce state oppression of black communities. Ultimately, it is a very touchy, it is an emotionally vulnerable thing to talk about, because from the outside, it looks like you're just talking about Latino criminals, black criminals, gangbangers. But for us, that is my cousin. For us, that is my brother, that's my niece, that's my sister, that's my uncle who just came back from the joint, that's my mom, that's my dad. In other words, that there is a twin conflict, because you are dealing with actual family members, not abstract numbers and not caricatures on a TV. And it is that conflict within the soul of how do you deal with people who have been deeply wounded by a life in crime And at the same time, you can't stop loving them. They don't stop loving you, but you still have somehow to pick up the scars and tie those scars back into the web of love, back into the web of community. How do you do that? All right, finally, that there is a question about, well, what are some of the causes about this? And the hardest thing to break in terms of the cause for quote-unquote black-on-black crime. Because people can say, doesn't every community that is struck by poverty resort to some level to crime? Is it more of a class thing? Hold on. Isn't it more of a class thing? And the reason that thing just kind of bothered me. And one of the reasons is in my neighborhood, I live in Bed-Stuy, right off of the corner of Nostrand in Quincy. I would say there's 2 to 3 shootings on my block at least every summer. Summer is the hot season, a lot of shootings. I don't know why, not so much in winter. Maybe the guns freeze up, maybe they're cheap guns, I don't know. A lot of shootings in the summer. A good friend of mine who I've known for years, there was a young man running and trying to shoot someone else. He obviously didn't get trained. He was just shooting wildly. He shot my friend 4 times. Luckily, he missed all the major arteries. I remember when I was walking to a bar, the Voodoo bar down the street, my friend Frankie waved me over. He was sitting in the truck, and he actually rolled up his sleeves and he rolled up his pant leg and he showed me the crust where the bullets had passed through and where the scab was. So I was deeply shaken. This is a friend of mine who I care for deeply. He's invited me to his house. He's teaching me guitar. And he was just millimeters away from having his blood spill out on the ground. Last story, I was in Oakland. I got a phone call from a friend of mine. She's like, you know, someone got shot on your block. And I was like, God, not again. And when I came back to New York, I saw that there was a small candle for a young 19-year-old girl named Beverly Turner who had gotten shot in the back 6 times, literally right down the block. And when I asked what had happened to one of my neighbors, he said, some dyke got shot because she was with some other guy. And I was just like, Now, this was at the height of Black Lives Matter. So, which means that I'm out there protesting on the Brooklyn Bridge. I'm out there protesting in the street, but I am coming home to incredible amounts of violence in my neighborhood. And I couldn't let go of that contradiction. So this is the final thesis that I'm gonna leave you. Is it just class? We all know that there's an incredible amount of internalized racism that we all have. Racism it's a toxic that is in the water that we all drink. And we also know that those of us, people of color, also have internalized racism too. Is it possible that on top of the poverty, on top of the weird American fetish with guns, which means that there's more guns in this country than there are people, is it possible that a certain internalized racism makes it easier for those of us of color to pull the trigger on other people of color? Because we've all drank the water. We all have the toxic inside of us. And my fear is that that part of black-on-black crime has only been indirectly addressed. Malcolm X talked about it when he says, who taught you how to hate your skin? Who taught you how to hate your hair, right? All along, there has been a critique by black revolutionaries of the effects of internalized racism. We see it in the fetishizing of light-skinned people, quote-unquote good hair. We see it in the way that we throw nigger around like a knife out of our mouths, slashing each other. So, yeah, sometimes it's said in love, but we also know that on the other side of that love is a razor. So I just want to ask that that's a possibility and to raise that as a conceptual intervention and to say, can that be included as a way of trying to purge ourselves of this idea of black-on-black crime? So with that, I'd like to actually give it to the brother Kazembe. And Kazembe, if you want to come up.
Nick Powers, poet, journalist with The Independent, and English professor at SUNY, the State University of New York. And you're listening to part 3 of Notes from the Left Forum, a conference which took place in New York City from June 2nd through June 4th, 2017. Speakers in this program are from a panel out of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College. Next up is Kazembe Balagan with the Rosa Luxemburg Foundation. He was raised in the projects in Harlem, near where Charlie Parker used to play concerts for the Communist League. He grew up in the 80s in the height of the crack epidemic, where traditional Southern communities were transported into the North. Kazembe says what racism does is it cuts society in two in an attack on black political power in New York City.
I think that we have to really go deeper a little bit more in terms of like what was going on in the 1960s, 1970s, where a lot of this stuff was started. And, you know, some of the work of like people like Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who came out with a report around benign neglect, that was also that they basically said that the issues around the black community were on the black people themselves, which was coming out of the radical revolutionary work of the 1960s, 1970s, the Black Power Movement, the Black Liberation Movement, the Black Panther Parties. Connected to that, too, is also this issue around planned shrinkage, the cutting of services in the 1970s, which really damaged our ability to even survive, even have housing. So my question is that, you know, in New York City right now, you know, me having my experience growing up in projects, we have a broken windows policy, but ain't nobody fixing no broken windows. You know? Like, the windows stay broken in the projects.
Supposedly it ended.
Yeah, it supposedly ended, but no. You know, and so, like, these gang raids are also also a reflection of that. The second part I want to bring up, too, is the fact that, like, how we kind of distance ourselves from our own brothers and sisters. For me, it's like, when you talk about gang rage and taking people out for 20, 30, 40 years, this is a form of displacement, an uprooting of people, uprooting of whole communities. And so that you don't see the people who really protect you anymore, you know? And these are very complicated situations, right? It's like everyone, like the same way that, you know, I'm sure people who, you know, who are drone operators go home to their families, you know what I'm saying? People who may be involved in the game are people who care about the community. They're the people who protect us. They're the people who talk to us. They're the people who tell you what's going on. And so when you take them out, you're taking out whole entire blocks of generations. The other thing I really want to talk about is, like, why are we talking about the projects now? You know what I'm saying? And, like, this is a very, I think this is very important because the one word that we have to really bring up is displacement and gentrification. Back when I was growing up in the 1980s and 1990s, you had to go downtown to see that, you know what I'm saying, below 110th Street, you know what I'm saying? Now there's a recolonization of Harlem, you know, in which you're seeing this wealth coming out into the projects. Right across the street from the projects, you have wealthy stores, you know, and Starbucks. And the projects and the housing authorities saying are some of the most valuable land in the city. So part of that is also talking about displacement. And to me, this is also a political question because then what you're talking about, too, is the attack against black political power throughout the city, right, and black and brown political power. And you see that as not so much as in terms of the relationship of, like, the stores that are there and everything else, because if you talk about the 1990s, then you have to connect that to the whole entire opening up of the free trade zones and the empowerment zones that were happening in Harlem and Upper Manhattan that were going on and a lot of that stuff. But also at the same time, the political disempowerment of these communities, the redistricting, the gerrymandering that was happening at the exact same time, you know? And the very fact that, you know, we had someone like Charles Rangel who finally was on the House committee. My dad, let me tell you, my dad only voted for two people in his whole entire life. Adam Clayton Powell, who you saw speak. You know, when he first got into Harlem, my dad, imagine this, my dad got out of a subway out of Harlem. He saw two people the first day he got to Harlem, Malcolm X and Adam Clayton Powell. And he was like, all right. You know? And then Charles Rangel. And then when Charles Rangel become the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, then he got suspended without any political backup, even from the new black political establishment. So what does that mean in terms of our own power in our communities? You know, so this is stuff that we have to do in terms of being redistricted and being pushed around. So I'm saying that to say is that part of this thing around the gang raids is that I think that everyone here agrees to this to a certain extent, that we really need to come come to each other and actually be able to see each other. And that's why I think this work is so innovative, because it's taking the least of us, the people that were considered, quote unquote, the most dangerous, and actually forced them up as the first, right? As political subjects, as people that we need to defend. Because the thing about the whole thing about the project is the reason that they can get away with it is because we're not seen as citizens. You know what I'm saying? Our citizenship was taken away from us. The same way that, you know, that happened right during New Orleans, you know, when people were evacuated and not allowed to come back, you know. So it's a matter of political citizenship that we have to engage in, you know, social, you know, overcoming social alienation and political power. And the last thing I want to say is that I really, you know, I want to take on Nick's challenge in terms of how do we see black on black crime. My own personal opinion, my own political opinion for what I've seen is that black-on-black crime is something that folks announce as an excuse to attack black people. You know, that being said, you know what I'm saying? Because I'm very careful in terms of what my enemy says and what the people say. So when Donald Trump says that, you know, I'm gonna deal with black-on-black crime, I'm gonna send the National Guard to Chicago, that's something to be worried about. You know, when we have this dude, Ben Carson, as a head of HUD, and he says poverty is a state of mind, you know, and that, you know, we came here as immigrants, you know, black folks, then that's something I worry about. But I also think that the other part of it, too, is that I think that we really do need to reengage and rebuild in terms of black civil society and black community and retake public space. You know, and we really need to have things that, like, you talk about a gang raid. We need to have, like, mass embodiment of indigenous communities, and it has to be many different types of people on the streets taking up space. You know what I'm saying? We need a reaffirmation of community. We need a reaffirmation of the public space. We need to take that public space and step out. You know, one of the best things I saw this week was a YouTube video, was that a group of folks from Queens, in Laurelton, I think it was, you know, there was an ICE raid against their neighbors. The whole community came out, was like, what are you doing? Let them go. That's our brother. You know what I'm saying? That was something that was really powerful to me in terms of how we can see ourselves. The last thing I would say is that we also have to really reclaim the projects as our own. There's a lot of laws that are going on right now. I think one of the sisters who was actually involved in the Bronx gang raid right now is being trying to kick her out. Yep. You know what I'm saying? If you're convicted of a felony, family members convicted of a felony, you're gonna be permanently kicked out of housing, which means in New York City, that means death. That means that you'd be completely displaced from New York City. You know? So I think that's something what on a very basic federal level, city level, that we have to challenge those laws that allow folks that really challenge that law.
You've been listening to Notes from the Left Forum, Part 3, with Professors David Brotherton and Nick Powers, and with Kazembe Balagan from a panel called Resisting NYPD Gang Policing, with a discussion on black-on-black crime, myth or reality. You can find out more about the Left Forum by going to leftforum.org. The conference was held in New York City from June 2nd through June 4th at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Linda Perry, WBAI News, Pacifica Radio, New York.